Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show here on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We are going to begin with a short, interesting interview out of the morning show archives devoted to the important work of teachers. Certainly one of the best known and most admired teachers in the entire country has to be Ron Clark. He was designated the 2001 Disney Teacher of the Year and has been a very visible presence ever since, a superbly gifted teacher who has a couple of books to his credit, one of them called The Essential 55, which outlines a number of different rules which he likes to follow in the classroom, the 55 important rules for his students to think about in order for them to have the most meaningful experience possible. And now he has written a great book called The Excellent 11, Qualities Teachers and Parents Use to Motivate, Inspire, and Educate Children. It's published by Hyperion. And Ron Clark joins us for a few minutes to talk about his life as a teacher and the experience of writing this book. Ron Clark, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I should think that it is no small matter to sit down and try to write a book about something which is, first of all, so important to you and something which is a very complicated sort of thing to unravel. How much did you learn about teaching and why you teach the way you do and how you teach the way you do? How much of that sort of came to you, did you come to understand, just in the process of trying to write about it in these two books?
You know, writing is an amazing thing. You know, getting your thoughts on paper and actually seeing it, you know, there in print, you know, it's totally different than just living it or just thinking your ideas. And it was very therapeutic for me. It allowed me to go through all of my ideas and kind of get things into a structure. And it was really nice to see how everything came together. But it was wonderful. And it was also nice that after I wrote The Essential 55, I traveled across the country. I went to 49 states talking to teachers and parents about what's really working in education in America. And I had so many great ideas and so many wonderful things I saw that these people were doing. And I just kept taking notes about things I saw that really worked. And it was nice to actually take the time and to put all of those ideas and all those creative strategies I saw into a book, and that's what The Excellent 11 became.
Mm. I want to ask you about a couple of those 11 essentials. The very first one, which is so evident to, for anyone who sees you or meets you, is enthusiasm. But one of the things you say is that enthusiasm is best when it serves a purpose, that just unbridled enthusiasm is not enough really to carry the day or to get the job done.
Right, exactly. I see some first-year teachers just spinning their wheels. They're so excited, and they're trying to motivate these kids, and they're doing these games and different things, and the kids are excited, but they're not really learning. And so I really try in my classroom to pull in education and really to make the core of what we're doing deal with the standard course of study and what these kids are required to know on their intergrade tests. You know, I'm really always standard-driven, making sure that, yes, there's a lot of enthusiasm. I'm excited. Sometimes I'll jump on my desk, whatever it takes to get these kids motivated, but I make sure that we're always focused on the curriculum and that there is a purpose in what these kids are learning. And I just beg my parents, I say, please, you know, when you're dealing with your kids, please have a positive outlook about education. You need to be enthusiastic as well about learning, because kids are so impressionable, whether they're 5 years old or whether they're 18 years old, and they look to their parents. And if their parents are enthusiastic about learning and enthusiastic about school and looking forward to the school year, then the kids will be as well.
You also, in kind of taking things full circle, when you get to your 11th essential, which is resilience, you hearken back to the whole issue of enthusiasm, and you remind us that over-enthusiasm is one of the things which can lead to burnout, which, of course, is an increasingly common phenomenon among teachers.
Right. And especially, you know, first-year teachers, I see these teachers enter school systems, and it's typical. It happens in every school where you go. The first-year teachers come in, and they're put on every committee. They're asked to be the coaches. They're asked to serve lunch duty. They're asked to do bus duty. And these teachers say yes. They're first-year teachers. They're excited. They have so much energy and enthusiasm. They want to do all of it. Then after 3 or 4 years, they burn out, and they leave the profession. And we're seeing that happen in schools all across America, that after 3 or 4 years, these exceptional teachers are leaving because they burn out. And so it's important that we have a balance in education. I tell teachers, you know, in order to teach about life, you have to have a life. You have to be willing to take some time for yourself. And I remember sometimes I would have a ton of papers to grade. My friends would say, let's go play tennis. And I'd say, you know what, I'm going to go play tennis. And I'd go play tennis. And the next morning I'd wake up and I'd be rejuvenated. And I'd go in that classroom and I'd say, you know what, kids, I looked through these. I didn't grade them. Let's go over them together. I mean, you don't have to feel like you have to grade everything. You don't have to feel like you have to be on every committee to coach everything. And it's okay to say no to the principal sometimes. And, you know, sometimes we just need to close our classroom doors, look at those kids, and focus on them. That's where we're going to get rejuvenated, not trying to serve on every committee or do all the bus duties or do everything that the principal asks. Sometimes it's necessary to say no, because if you don't, you're going to burn out.
You're touching on something which is, I think, essential number four, which is reflection. You say one of the best qualities of an exceptional teacher is that he or she learns something from every lesson that is taught, and it takes a moment of reflection, of course, to be able to really achieve that. I suppose for many teachers, it's likely that they get into a cycle, a frantic kind of cycle, which doesn't leave a lot of time for reflection unless you really make a point of including it in your life.
Right. No, it all leads back to organization. I keep this binder. Every lesson I do, I devote one sheet of paper in the binder to that lesson, one sheet of paper for every day during that school year. And then after I'm teaching my lessons, after I'm doing different things, I go over and I make notes. I jot down notes of things that worked, things that didn't work, and it helps me. Lots of teachers do this. They keep worksheets that work. They keep information. They keep all different types of little notes for themselves. And so the next year, they can go through that binder, remind themselves, they can reflect on what worked. It'll make them be a better teacher. And everyone knows, you know, if you teach high school history and you teach 5 periods a day, that fifth period, those kids are lucky. They're going to get the best lesson. You know, the first period, you're learning about that lesson. The second period, you're getting into it. By the fifth period, you know, you've really learned how to master that lesson. You're doing it the best, you know. And if we just will take the time to reflect on what we've done, you know, we'll become better teachers. And also, reflection is important for kids. I love how I see first grade teachers. They'll give little kids on the first day of school, they'll say, all right, first graders, I want you to write one sentence on this sheet of paper. And some of them can, some of them can't, some of them really struggle. Then they'll take up those pieces of paper. Then on the last day of school, they'll give out another sheet of paper. They'll say, now you write a sentence. And then they'll write this beautiful sentence, all of them. Then she'll staple the pieces of paper together and pass them out, and she'll say, look how much you learned this year. I mean, it's wonderful for teachers to reflect and parents to reflect, but also for kids to reflect and say, oh, look how much I learned. You know, that will instill pride in these kids and make them feel good about themselves and encourage them to want to learn more in the future.
I love the story you told about your own sixth grade teacher, Mrs. Walker, who had every student in the classroom keep a daily diary of what occurred there. And those diaries stayed in the room until the last day of school, when you were allowed to take them home. And you said you walked out of there feeling like you were holding $1 million. That was such a powerful tool of learning for you.
Yeah. During sixth grade, Miss Walker, she almost drove me crazy, because every day, you know, no matter what happened, we were going to write in that journal for 5 minutes that day. And some days I didn't want to write in it. I didn't think I had anything to write. But she always encouraged us to write about our emotions, our feelings, what was going on. And on that last day when she gave it to us, you know, all those ideas were in there, and I just cherished it so much at that moment, but I had no idea. Now it's one of my most prized possessions in the world, because I don't remember much from my fourth or fifth grade year. I remember some things from seventh grade, but my sixth grade year, it's just vividly clear. I can remember where I sat, my friends, on the lessons that we taught, how we changed classes. I can remember racing Hallett Moore and almost beating him in the sixth grade race. I mean, all these things I can remember because she took the time to say, we're going to reflect on this year, and you're going to learn about what life is like in the eyes of an 11-year-old. And now I can look back and see how I felt at that age, and it's just a wonderful thing.
In the chapter devoted to adventure, trying to foster a sense of adventure in the classroom, I think you really do teachers a great service by talking about realistic adventure that I suppose, particularly in this day and age, one really has to temper what might be the limits of your imagination on what sorts of adventures to take your classroom on, be it vicarious adventures or whatever, but that one has to have this sense of what is realistic, what is workable, what is going to ultimately achieve something meaningful for these young people.
Right. The first step with adventure is that I always tell my kids, don't sit on your dreams. If there's something that you want to do, go for it. I want them to have courage. I want them to have determination to do these things, and I try and set an example for them. And also with adventure in the classroom, I try to do things to spice up that year. You know, especially if you're dealing with junior high students, you can't just present the information to them. They're not going to get it. They need it to be exciting. They need it to be spiced up. They need something to really catch their attention and to be different. And doing adventure and pulling in, whether it's a scavenger hunt or something unusual or something where if you can manage to take them on a field trip where they're learning on that field trip, whatever you're doing, it's important to make things a little bit spicy, to make things a little different, and to add adventure into that classroom. And to my parents and my students, I say, listen, if you're dealing with a 13-year-old kid, and if you're having troubles with that kid and you can't, if you don't have a good relationship or you can't relate to each other, then the best way to pull yourself together is to do something dealing with an adventure. When we're challenged at the same time, it bonds us. Like, for example, if you could take your 13-year-old to a local rock climbing wall, I know some parents are like, there ain't no way in the world I'm going up a rock climbing wall. But if you can do it, if you could push yourself a little bit, challenge yourself and challenge your 13-year-old and do it together, when you're done, you're going to feel like, yes, we did it. It's going to bond you together. Go to a local amusement park and ride a roller coaster together. Go camping. I know some of these things might be difficult and they take some time, but if you can do them, you're really going to do a lot to foster a good relationship with your 13-year-old or your child, no matter what age they are.
I was a bit surprised when you said the number one thing parents and teachers can do to positively affect the lives of our children and students is to become more aware of the way we speak to them.
That's it. Words are so powerful. And I see so many teachers and parents telling kids, you're always talking, you're so disrespectful, you're so rude, your room's always a mess, you're doing this, you're the worst class I've seen. And kids are impressionable. They look to us to see who they are. They see themselves in our eyes. Whether they're 18-year-olds or 5-year-olds, they respect us whether or not we believe it, and they look to us to see who they are. And when we look at them, we've got to make sure we're speaking to them in a manner that points out their positive qualities, the things that they're doing well, and shows them their potential. Words are powerful.
In our last minute, I want to find out from you this great adventure which you have been on since been giving this great award. Has it been something of a disruption in your own teaching career? I mean, are you able still to be in the classroom as a teacher, or if not at the moment, do you look forward to the day when life will calm down and you can do what you've always done?
Right. I'm not a conventional teacher right now. I am still teaching, but I'm not in the classroom. I'm traveling with kids all around the world, going to Japan, taking kids from Harlem. We just got back from South Africa. And so we're traveling all around the world. I'm taking kids from disadvantaged areas and doing these things and teaching them through that way. And I'm traveling across the country, talking to teachers and parents. And so I'm not a regular classroom teacher right now, and I won't be until next year, next fall. But I'm just really enjoying this time, but I miss the classroom. That's my passion. That's where my heart is, and so I'm really looking forward to getting back in there. But we started something really neat. It's this website called www.ronclark.info, I-N-F-O. It's a place where teachers can go, or parents, and you can type in questions. And all these different teachers and parents across America will give you advice and tips, and you can ask me questions, and it's been wonderful. So that's taken up so much of my time, and the traveling and promoting the books and things like that. It's just been really busy, but I'm looking forward to getting back into the classroom next fall. I can't wait.
And I'm sure the classroom is eager to have you back. The book, again, is The Excellent 11. It's author Ron Clark. Ron Clark, I thank you for joining us and for all of your good work which you have done on behalf of teachers everywhere.
No, thank you so much. Thank you.
The time is 8:27 exactly, and you are listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTDHD. I'm Gregory Berg. For part two of today's program, we're going to be welcoming into our studios Dr. James Kinchin, who is Director of Choral Activities at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. And we'll be talking with him about beautiful music of Franz Josef Haydn, which is going to be performed this coming Friday evening by singers of UW-Parkside joining forces with singers from Horlick High School in Racine, playing and singing music of Haydn. Here's a little sample before we get to our interview with Dr. James Kinchin. Beautiful music of Franz Josef Haydn, and this is from his Kleine Orgelmesse, his Little Organ Mass, one of the Missa Brevis, short mass settings of this great classical master. And joining me in the studios is Dr. James Kinchin, who is Director of Choral Activities at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. And he is here to talk about this beautiful work by Franz Josef Haydn, which, as I mentioned, is going to be performed this Friday evening in collaboration with the William Horlick Chorale from Horlick High School in Racine under the direction of Ellen Christensen. And this is part of an ongoing series of concerts which are called Experiencing Choral Treasures. And many, if not all, of these so-named concerts involve collaborations of one kind or another, and it's an exciting undertaking. Dr. James Kinchin, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. It's always a pleasure to be here with you.
Well, great to have you here. Thank you for making your way through the inhospitable elements that that southeastern Wisconsin is experiencing today. Fortunately, the weather should be nice and calm, at least for the most part, by this weekend. So first of all, say a quick word about this series of concerts called Experiencing Choral Treasures. I know at least one has already occurred that we talked about back in the fall.
Yes. Well, it's a fairly new series that we've inaugurated, and the idea is to use the fairly short to mid-sized choral orchestral work as a kind of focus, if you will, for bringing onto our campus and into our wonderful performing space, the Francis Bedford Concert Hall, some of our outstanding high school choirs from the area, to give them an opportunity to share with us in the performance of some of those shorter masterworks. And for many of those choirs, it is, if not a first time, it's a rare opportunity to perform with an orchestra, which is also part of that deal. And it gives me an opportunity to connect with my conductor colleagues of those choirs who each in his or her own right does a really wonderful job. And so we, as you mentioned, in the fall, we welcomed for the inaugural concert the Milwaukee High School of the Arts Chorale that was directed by Raymond Roberts. And we performed the Nunez Garcia, a name not a lot of people know, but he was an Afro-Brazilian composer who wrote in the classical style, his Requiem setting. And so this spring, we're really, really excited about the collaboration that we have with the William Horlick High School Chorale under the direction of Ellen Christensen to perform this wonderful short mass by Haydn. It's been nicknamed the Little Organ Mass, the Kleine Orgelmesse, but it is that the full proper name of it is the Missa Brevis Sancti Johannes de Deo.
A mouthful.
It is a mouthful.
Tell us a little bit about the choice of this specific work. And you were telling me before we went on the air that this was a work that you and Ellen Christensen chose together in collaboration. And I suspect there's a host of reasons why it is so very suitable for a collaboration like this. What are at least some of those reasons?
Well, it's a really fine little jewel by one of the great composers of all time, Franz Joseph Haydn. It is, if you put it into performance context, is one of those things that's very singable, you know, very well written for the voice. It is concise, and yet at the same time, it's beautiful music. It's sort of right at the intersection of art and function, if you will.
Yes.
And you know, if you look at it from a historic perspective, it represents the last of the Missa Brevis settings of Haydn, and it comes at a point where he is beginning to come fully into his own maturity as a composer. That one of his biographers, Geiringer, I think it was, talked about him having four periods in his life. Mm. And so this comes in that third period. Mm. He is at this point beginning to really master the classical, capital C, musical vocabulary and style, and to bring that into song, which again is a whole nother story, if you will, how that's coming from a lot of different places and as a result of different strands being woven together. And finally, you know, you have a really coherent style and Haydn showing himself masterfully as being able to use that in a beautiful way. And so here's a short, concise example of this. It's about 25 minutes in length.
Explain, although to some extent it's probably fairly self-explanatory, but something really specific is meant by this term Missa Brevis, or short mass. Typically, what makes these masses shorter, or in what way are they shorter than a more standard mass setting?
Well, I think there are two or three things. One thing is by intent, these settings are designed to be used, actually used liturgically. And if you look at, to go through the other extreme, some of the examples of the Mass as concert piece, the Bach B minor Mass, for example, comes to mind. The Beethoven Missa Solemnis comes to mind. Those were works that were not intended to have liturgical function. They were intended for the concert hall, but the Missa Brevi setting is intended to actually be used. There's a certain eye toward conciseness from the beginning, not being as expansive as one might be in setting the movements. Often in the Gloria and in the Credo, there is some overlapping of what I sometimes refer to as pancaking of texts, so that you have what normally are very wordy pieces of the ordinary made more concise by different sections singing different words at the same time. And so all of those come into play. Now, with this particular Mass, all of that happens to some extent, even though we have elected to do a Gloria setting that was elongated by Haydn's brother Michael.
Oh.
Which is, simply to give it a little bit more, to have a movement that's a little bit more expansive, but it's very faithfully done, I think.
So this is something in which Franz Joseph Haydn's brother Michael Haydn took something Franz Joseph Haydn composed and expanded on it. It's not that Michael Haydn just inserted his own Gloria.
No. He expanded it, and he uses faithfully all of the motivic and thematic material that Franz uses. And by the way, it's said that Franz Haydn considered his brother to be an even better composer of sacred music. I don't know whether that's false modesty. I suspect that there is some humility to that that's not necessarily borne out in the reality of Haydn's excellent writing, but that explains the Missa Brevis, with the one exception of the Benedictus, which is really just a jewel. It's essentially an aria, and it involves soprano and the organ playing a solo. Which is why the organ gets to have a prominent role in the naming or the nicknaming of this Mass.
Can you tell us more about why that happened? I mean, how it earned this particular nickname? I mean, in terms of for whom it was originally written, and was this a really special organ that was involved in its premiere or something? Or do we not know?
Well, we know some things about it, and I don't know that the organ still exists right now. But a few decades ago, it still did. Hmm. The Mass was written for a charitable order, Brothers of Charity, Brothers of Mercy. And they had their beginnings inspired by the unselfish work of a 16th century Portuguese monk whose name was Juan Ciudad. And so that's why they were called the Brothers of St. John of God. That was the name that he was given, because he was so giving and so charitable. And so they had in the Austrian town of Eisenstadt a small church, which was part of their monastery. And this small church had this small organ. And I understand that it had like five sets of stops. It wasn't very large or very elaborate, but because Haydn knew this order and was asked to write this Mass, he made the organ, in a sense, especially in that Benedictus movement, the focal point of the Mass, and hence it got its nickname.
Mm, very good. So tell us what kind of organ is in the Francis Bedford Concert Hall, or do you have to sort of bring something in or bring in some kind of keyboard?
Well, that's a good question, and I chuckled because we are very, very excited in our department and in our college at the opportunity to finally get raise funds to get installed an organ that we actually own, but has been in storage on the campus.
Wow.
That would be just versatile enough. I mean, it could do bigger stuff, but it would be versatile enough to do this. But as of right now, we'll have to settle for a small Continuo, which synthesizes an organ sound to make this happen.
Okay. So, but we look forward to one of these days.
We do too.
Organ being installed and ready. So, at this point in time, what rehearsal have you done with the young singers at Horlick High School who are typically under the direction of Ellen Christensen? Yeah. What kind of contact have you had with them thus far?
Well, I have actually, and that's an interesting question, I have actually not had direct contact with them. It has been a consultation with, now I will, obviously, but at this point it has been consultation with their director, in whom I have lots of confidence as a musical colleague, talking about things like tempi, you know, and phrasing and those kinds of things. And so I'm eagerly looking forward to the opportunity to get with them, you know, after they now will have gotten all of their notes solidified and go about the business of making just incredibly nice music.
Mm. And I remember from the article in the Journal Times that I read that Ellen Christensen said that at least for the vast majority of her singers, this is going to be the first time that they have performed with this kind of orchestral accompaniment. And the first time a young singer gets to experience that is always especially exciting.
It is. You know, and one of the things we were talking earlier about the whole concept of experiencing choral treasures, one of the things that that I get excited about, I got excited about, and am still excited about with this series, is how that opens that door of experience to the high school singer. I remember when I was in high school, and any instrument that we had to come in and play with us was like, wow, you know, and we never had the opportunity to perform with an entire orchestra, but that would have been absolutely heavenly.
Mm-hmm.
Making that experience happen, it just stokes the musical imagination in ways that otherwise don't happen.
Hmm. So, as you said, this Haydn work is relatively modest in scope, and so one of the nice things about that is it also allows you to fill out the program with other wonderful music. Do you want to give us some sense of what the balance of the program will include?
Well, I'm always sort of the worst one to do that. When somebody says, what are you doing? And I just draw a blank and I'm working on these things. But let me start with the contributions that our friends are going to make. They're going to do the Horlick Chorale. We'll do a solo set, and in that set will be the gorgeous Bruckner Ave Maria, and also Eric Whitaker's A Boy and a Girl. My chamber choir will perform a full anthem by Thomas Tompkins, Praise the Lord, O My Soul. A beautiful To Die For setting of Danny Boy by Doug Andrews.
Oh, yeah.
And we'll also do a couple of African-American folk songs, what we colloquially call spirituals. I Want to Die Easy in a setting by Roland Carter out of the Hampton tradition. And Little Innocent Lamb. By Marshall. It's an arrangement of Marshall Bartholomew's, and there's more of a story there than I know to tell. But Marshall Bartholomew was for many decades the director of the Yale Glee Club. But he happened to have been somehow able to collect this song, which is what they did in those days. I think this was in the 20s, so it's before people could tote recording equipment around.
Sure.
In a place called Oak Grove, North Carolina, which I actually found it sort of like kind of north between the Piedmont and the mountains in North Carolina, called Little Innocent Lamb, and he made an arrangement of that, and so we'll do that. And also by University Chorale will be heard. We'll sing Baba Yetu and will also do a piece of Glenn Burley's.
Okay. And, of course, the Francis Bedford Concert Hall is such a gorgeous space. I feel like everything I've ever heard there has just reinforced how beautifully designed that space is, and particularly for voices. You have to feel so fortunate to have a beautiful space like that in which to present your choirs.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's a jewel of a space, and it was transformative in more ways than, I mean, you don't have enough time for me to sit here and tell you all of the ways that it has been really for us a total game-changing experience. Mm. But yeah, that's like heavenly.
Wonderful. So the concert then is this Friday evening at 7:30 in the beautiful Francis Bedford Concert Hall, right in the heart of the Rita. The Rita Talent Pickens Center for Arts and Humanities.
That's close.
And the choirs of the University of Wisconsin Parkside, in collaboration with the William Horlick Chorale from Horlick High School in Racine, under the direction of Ellen Christensen, and the centerpiece of that concert, Franz Josef Haydn's Little Organ Mass. Again, Friday night, 7:30 p.m. is the concert. Tickets available at the door, I would assume.
Yes, they are.
And we'll hear just a little bit more of this mass to finish out this portion of the morning show. Dr. James Kinchin, is always such a pleasure to speak with you, and best wishes to you and all of your singers with Friday night's concert. It sounds like a very special evening of music indeed.
Thank you so much, Greg. It's always a pleasure to be here.
And here's just a bit more of the Haydn Little Organ Mass. It's 8:49 here on WGTD. To finish out the hour, here is a portion of a very memorable conversation from some years ago, which I was privileged to have with the great Maya Angelou. And this was on the occasion that of the publication of a beautiful poem she was asked by the U.S. State Department to write in memory of Nelson Mandela upon his death, a poem called His Day Is Done. I asked Maya Angelou, Dr. Angelou, to explain what was behind her choice of words there with His Day Is Done.
Well, I know that in the course of living, that each of us has a day we have coming to us. And it will mean, when that day arrives, it will mean that all our work is done, all the work we have to do in this particular life is done. And I thought of all the work he had done, and I was so proud, and I still am so proud. I just couldn't think of any better way to say his work is done, his day is done. He has received the Nobel from the world. He's received the love of his children and the love of his fellow South Africans. And I went to his inauguration and saw that he had invited his former guards, the guards who had guarded him for 27 years in prison. He invited them to find seats at his inauguration, not to say, look at what you did and look at who I am today. He did it out of his kindness. He said, this is our country. It is the whites and the blacks and the Asians. This is our country. And we have no time for evil. We have no time for anger or rancor or bitterness. Mm. Let us raise and develop our country. And, Greg, you know, one of the things so amazing is that there are people who actually go to South Africa on vacation. I mean, it's so amazing when I know how apartheid had so cut the country into bits and pieces. And now it's a place you go and brag about going.
Amazing. I mean, and that Nelson Mandela would be the man at this crucial moment in his country's history to usher it into this new era. At one point, you thank him, our David, and at another point, you thank him, our Gideon. Explain to our listeners how you are, in your mind, likening him to the figures of David and Gideon.
Thank you. David was a small shepherd boy, really, and before he became the king of Israel. But when the giant Goliath was threatening Israel, David took a stone and said, "I will best this giant. I will rid us of this this threat." And people laughed at him, but he took a stone and bested Goliath. And Gideon was so strong, he was able to rid Israel of the threats of armed men against it, against the country. Again, with almost nothing. He didn't have the armory. He didn't have the great knives and rifle. He didn't have anything except his will and his will to do the right thing. And so I think of men and women, people throughout the world who have done great things with nothing. I think of Rosa Parks, who just said, "No, I will not get up. I will not," she was told, "You must get up from this seat in the public conveyance and give it to a white man." She said, "I will not get up. I will not." That's the kind of moxie, the kind of control, and the desire to do the good thing for the right reason.
At the very end of this beautiful book, you write, "No sun outlasts its sunset, but will rise again and bring the dawn." Help our listeners understand this way in which no sun outlasts its sunset. That's beautifully put.
When it is time, when your day is done, it is time to go. Then you may go, but don't fear that all your work will have been done in vain. There'll be some people coming up to continue that work and do it as well as they can. They may not be Nelson Mandela. They may not be they may not be this image of the person who had been the inspiration, but the work will be done. It will continue to be done because it must be done. That's what I meant.
Beautifully put. I'm so glad to know more about what was behind that. And your book, as you've just hinted, is about not just Nelson Mandela, but about the work that remains to be done. You write at one point, "Yet we, his inheritors, will open the gates wider for reconciliation."
Yes, exactly. Got it.
I've wanted to ask you for a long time, and this is not in just regards to this beautiful book, but everything else you've written. Earlier in your life, and maybe still to some extent, you were and are a singer and a dancer. And as a musician myself, I wonder if you would just say a word about how that background and experience as being a singer and a dancer has anything to do with the way you use language, And if music is, in a sense, part of you, even as you are doing something that on the surface has nothing to do with singing or dancing or music.
True. I thank you for that question, because music has a lot to do with everything I do, and dance, probably dance more than music, except that the two go hand in hand, or foot in hand. When I was about 14, I started studying dance, and I had been a mute for a few years, and so I wasn't used to speaking. But dance caught my fancy, and even till this day, I can say honestly, bravely, that the only two things I ever really loved enough to sacrifice for were dance and writing. But I had a fabulous teacher who explained to me what dance was. She said, what we want you to do is occupy space. I heard that. I mean, I really understood what she meant. So I thought of my body as a piece of maybe costume, and I moved around the dance floor, occupying space. Well, once I did that, I could see how poetry was also a way of occupying space. And if I could make it even and make it make some sense and make it smooth, then people could read it. A woman in Des Moines, Iowa could read it, and an Asian man in Kowloon could read it, and an African-American teenager could read it in Atlanta. And I mean, I could see, if I can do that with lyric, then that's the same as dancing.
Maya Angelou, what a great privilege to speak with her. The occasion of recording this interview was the publication of a beautiful extended poem that she was commissioned to write in memory of Nelson Mandela. The name of that poem and the book, His Day Is Done, published by Random House. Tomorrow on the morning show, a couple of different interviews, including one with the author of a remarkable book called Diaspora, which is a look at the history of the Jewish people around the world, and in particular, the way in which they have experienced diaspora, disbursement across the globe. Thursday, Dr. Art Sear will join me for his monthly visit